According to the FBI, there are an estimated 1.4 million violent crimes in America each year. On the night of February 11, 2005, Kristen McKay and James Hoyt left a friend's wedding reception and returned to the Hoyt family's summer home. The brutal events that took place there are still not entirely known.
Welcome to Now Playing's The Strangers, bonus movie retrospective series.
Why are you doing this to us?
Because you were home.
Hosted by Jacob, Arnie, and Stuart.
Just the three of you again, like it always should have been, right?
This episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Are you sure that's what you want?
Yeah.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Leave us alone!
But we've just started.
Today we're discussing The Strangers, starring Liv Tyler, Scott Speedman, directed by Brian Bertino. This is the Now Playing co-host who has a face that we hide away forever, and I take them out and show ourselves when everyone is gone, Arnie.
And Stuart.
Tamara isn't here, but I am. This is Jacob.
Welcome, fall silver level donors. Feels like we just got done with summer, but it's true. We are starting a new series. A little bit different this time. I feel like sometimes we're just covering a franchise. It's easy to just say, here it is. This is, I would say, one of my favorite phylums of the horror genre. Home invasion movies are some of the most brutal and realistic that you're going to get. And we already talked about on Straw Dogs. It's just one that I've gone back to again and again. We've been fortunate, I think, because there have been a lot of cool little movies in the genre over the last 15 years that just weren't big enough to be their own franchise. So we get to stick them all together here and present them as one 5-part silver level donation drive. But I do believe that the trend started here. It's the fact that this $9 million movie made $80 million. I think The Strangers is the kickoff to that interest. And we would get Purge and Don't Breathe and You're Next. A lot of the stuff that we're covering or have already covered came out of how wildly popular this movie ended up being. And it's just the genre of our times, right? And having spent a year and a half COVID pandemic in our homes, thinking about the confines, thinking about threats exterior and tensions interior, I just do feel like probably everyone in the planet can think about their home environment as a place of terror.
I'm sure you remember, Stuart, my plans of getting a gun because I lived in a 2-story apartment and felt for sure somebody was going to break in on the first floor. I'd be trapped on the second floor and just need a gun to point around the corner and start shooting. So yeah, I feared home invasion. My mother actually still does. My father died several years ago. My mother also, 2-story house, just kept telling me how paranoid she was. Master bedroom on the second floor. If somebody broke into the house, she'd have no way out. She sleeps in her living room.
You're supposed to buy one of those little ladders you could throw out your window in case of a fire. We got one of those.
I always wanted one of those. Those are so cool. I don't live in constant fear that people are going to break into my house. It's one that it's easier to indulge in and get scared with when you're watching late at night, right? And you realize, oh, wow, the house creaks and makes noises. And suddenly, nighttime itself can turn a familiar, safe environment like your home into a place of real terror. It doesn't have to be a haunted house to scare the shit out of you if they've calibrated it correctly.
Admittedly, if I'm up really late and Marjorie goes to bed and I'm watching one of these films, they are the only movies that can actually get me a little spooked walking around the dark house alone at night. And it's not I'm afraid of goblins or ghosts or anything else, but there always could be somebody who broke into your house hiding in the closet.
Yeah, again, realistic. The reason why this one always plays is that maybe you don't believe in demons. Maybe you don't believe in ghosts. Maybe you don't live near a giant crater or something, a pit to hell or something. But everyone knows that there are nutcases out in the world. You've met them, you've seen them, and yes, maybe they follow you home. I just think, particularly in these days, home has come to mean something very primal to us, and the invasion of it and what that could mean. And yeah, I just feel like this is the great time to do this series. Of course, it doesn't hurt the fact that we have a Don't Breathe 2 just came out in movie theaters. And maybe some of you are surprised. We were going to originally cover Don't Breathe first, but it kind of makes more sense to start with this 2008 movie. I'm going to argue this is where the new home invasion classics began. Did you guys see it back in the day?
If 2018 was back in the day, I saw it. Like, this and the sequel are both on Netflix, and I remember just going through, you know, looking for something to watch, and it has a striking poster, like these three strangers with their masks. I'm like, oh, this looks like it might be fun. And so I watched that first film, never watched the second one, and I had heard that it had this big cult following. So I'm interested in listening to see why.
I saw this back in the day. I didn't see it in theaters, but I saw it pretty much as soon as it was available through Netflix when they used to mail you discs.
They still do, I think.
I get them.
I remembered liking it a lot. Now, when we get to the sequel, it came out during a crowded time in a crowded theater. I've never seen the sequel. I'm going to be a newbie to that one, but I think you can call me the fan of this one coming in.
I was real surprised by this. Again, soft spot for the genre. Didn't go when this opened at the beginning of summer, but LA hosts a lot of free screenings, and sometimes with the filmmakers, and they were advertising you could come see this movie that I had heard was pretty good. And I went, we watched half of it, and then the projector broke down, and I was immediately calling people and being like, have you seen this movie? It is scary as shit. Like, I couldn't believe how well it played to a jaded home invasion fan. And I really was super knocked out by it back in my sole theatrical watching in 2008.
Did you ever hunt down the second half?
Yeah, they did eventually get it up and running. I saw the whole movie.
Oh, okay.
But I did have 45 minutes on my phone in between. Again, I was just calling people and being like, have you heard of this movie, The Strangers? And they're like, no. And I'm like, yeah, you need to. I was convinced just by the first half of the movie. And I did go 3 years ago, I guess it was, to see the sequel. When it came out, absolutely, I was going to be there. So I, too, consider myself a fan, both of all the movies that are here and specifically for The Strangers. And the reason why I think I would list it as a classic, the reason why it's novel or, you know, maybe feels different is the risks it takes with minimalism. It is shocking how much they're not going to explain, how defiant they are to giving you what you expect from a screenplay. The only other movie that I can think of, Funny Games, that was a home invasion movie from the late 90s, that did get remade in America around the same time that this movie was made. Same idea that the killers will never tell you why they're doing it. The horror of it is, it's almost Kafkian. You're doomed to die for reasons you'll never understand. And it becomes a game as in Guess My Motive. Strangers is even more, I think, scary because these invaders don't even talk. The Funny Games guys, they're always cracking jokes. They're always making wise. But yeah, what these things are, what they represent, Rorschach blots.
Well, what they represent, when the movie starts, it says it's based on a true story.
That's a lie.
It's kind of based on a true story. The Manson family.
I mean, isn't everything kind of based on a true story?
Yeah, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre is based on Ed Gein.
Yeah, it's the Manson family plus the writer-director, Brian Bertino. When he was a child, at night late, somebody knocked on the door and it was a girl asking if Tamara was home, and they closed the door. It turned out that girl was going door to door and anyone who didn't answer got robbed.
So that actually happened to him?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, they were looking for the empty houses, not the full houses, but
it was actually good he answered the door, because had he not been home or had they been lazy and not even answered, then someone would have been coming through their window.
Yes.
Wow. Creepy. Yeah, that those kind of stories spook me. That is a memorable moment in this movie, and I can imagine if it happened to you in real life, you would hold on to it and find a way to put it in a movie, because it is just absolutely terrifying to think people coming door to door, just in general. It doesn't happen that much anymore. I don't know about where you guys live, but no one ever comes knocking on my door. So when they do, creepy.
When they do, there's usually a problem. Like, they're trying to sell something, steal something. I had a couple people come and under the guise of spreading religion, but they were in jeans and dirty t-shirts, and my Ring camera caught them pointing at windows and pointing at other things like they could see where entrances were to my house. Like, we could get in there. I did not like that.
Mm.
But even when they seem legitimate, like, oh, we're a lawn service, it still makes me nervous if they're coming door to door. Leave a flyer like a normal person.
That I'll just throw away, let's be honest.
So just don't come to my door.
Don't come to my door. That doesn't work for me.
No, that's their other tactic. They put the flyer on your door and then they go around at night. Whoever didn't take their flyer down must not be home.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a ruse to get us.
Yeah, they're just bad. If they're knocking on the door, doesn't matter who they are. Just shoot first and ask questions later.
But Brian Bertino, this person coming to his door must be the best thing that happened to him. I mean, this is the third screenplay he's ever written, entered it in a contest, got picked up by Universal Pictures, kind of went through development hell for a little bit, ended up... they ended up shuttling it over to the Rogue Pictures subsidiary, who then said, you've never done anything before. How would you like to direct this for $10 million?
Although I heard at some point Mark Romanek was going to do this, who is not unlike David Fincher. You know, we talked about with Panic Room and that music video creator, like wanting to make a simple home invasion movie that ended up costing $60 million. Mark Romanek was someone that made some really creative music videos throughout the 90s. I think he's a friend of David Fincher. He did the Girl with Dragon Tattoo opening, if you remember that very splashy way to that movie, the credit sequence. He had done One Hour Photo with Robin Williams, has a real unique visual style, but never really did well in the movies. I think he asked for too much money.
He wanted $40 million to make this movie.
There you go. And that's probably like lowballing it. It probably would have ended up like Fincher ending up being 80 or 90.
I don't think Rogue Pictures does that kind of movie.
No. No, yes. It should be said that Rogue Pictures is no more because, yeah, they tried to do B-pictures and low-budget movies, and most of them were not successful. I think The Strangers and Limitless are their only films that were, like, major hits.
The Bradley Cooper film where he takes drugs to make him smart?
Yeah, that made $80
million. Wow.
Yeah, they made a TV series out of that.
What?
Mm-hmm.
I remember not liking that movie. That's shocking. Okay.
Well, I didn't say it was good. I said it was a hit. And so because we're not going to pay Mark Romanek kind of money, they just give it to the guy that wrote the script. And turns out he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, he'd never directed anything before. He'd never had any professional work. And here he is getting offered this job. And he ended up making this film big success. It sat on a shelf for a couple years. I don't think the studio ended up having much confidence in it. But
right.
They ended up releasing it to, as you say, huge success, made almost 10 times its budget.
Well, let's get into it, Arnie, given the plot, and we'll learn about The Strangers.
Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman play Kristen McKay and her boyfriend James Hoyt. While attending a friend's wedding, James proposed to Kristen, and Kristen says no. This leads to an uncomfortable night at their cabin. James calls his friend Mike, played by Glenn Horton, to come get him so he and Kristen can have some space. The two lovers put aside their hurt feelings when a strange woman comes knocking on their door asking, "Is Tamara home?" She goes off in the night, but returns wearing a doll mask, and she's accompanied by two other masked adults. They start to terrorize the couple, breaking into their cabin, smashing their cell phones. James gets his father's shotgun to defend himself, but he ends up shooting and killing Mike, who walked into the house unaware of the situation. From there, James tries to fight back against the intruders, and Kristen goes to the CB to call for help, but both are captured and tied up and murdered. The next day, two children distributing religious pamphlets come across the cabin with the open door. They go in to see the bodies, but Kristen isn't quite dead. She wakes up and screams as credits roll.
Yep, and as they start, we are seasoned horror movie goers. I think when they flash on the based on a true story intertitles, none of us believe that, right? Like, we know that this did not happen on February 11th, 2005, or any other date. This is a fictional movie.
Correct.
Well, Stuart, you mentioned Texas Chainsaw. Did they try to get a John Larroquette sound-alike even? Because this was screaming from that opening.
Yeah, clearly a fan of 70s. I mean, this house we're in, like, it just feels like the 70s.
The fact that there's going to be so much record playing seems straight out of Straw Dogs.
It does feel like a home that would have been invaded in 1978, not 2008. Although, again, this movie was shot and sat on a shelf, so if you had heard that it happened in 2005, I think this movie was shot in 2006. So they were trying to make it seem like this was something that happened so recently, maybe you hadn't heard it yet, that it was hot off the news press.
And this was Bertino basing it a lot on his childhood. This movie was shot in South Carolina. It never says where it's taking place, but Marjorie noticed when she was watching this with me, Blue Bell Products, it's a food brand. And she's like, Blue Bell, is this in Texas? Apparently that's a Texan brand. And Bertino is from Texas. So even though this was filmed in South Carolina, he was bringing Texas local foods. And this was designed a lot based on the house where he grew up. He said, all these horror movies are in two-story Gothic structures. I grew up in a ranch house. I think that's a little scarier. You're stuck on the same floor as the people. So let's go with that. The people at Rogue didn't even want to do this. He had to convince them to go with this house. I think that does explain the record player too, because he's about our age.
Yeah, no stairs is definitely, like, it sounds funny to say it, but that is like an innovation in the home invasion. Like, you always have them running up and down stairs, cellars and basements.
I didn't even catch that, but the fact that it feels almost like it's a cabin in the woods, this is a summer home, the number of stories on the house didn't come across to me at all.
And again, if he's from Texas, I have to believe Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he's thinking about that movie a lot in placing this. I do feel like this could be Leatherface invading, and very little about it would need to be changed.
Even Leatherface gets more backstory than these characters do, though.
Every slasher ever has more backstory than these slashers.
Right. All right. Well, we'll get to that. First, we get a little bit of prologue where we see suburbia and then it kind of falls away. We're moving on a tracking shot out into the country. We understand that this is not happening in an urban environment. It's got to be isolated from where anyone can help you, but close enough to civilization that the Mormons can find you. We have these two boys that are going around. We'll eventually see their religious pamphlets, but they are soliciting for the LDS.
I guess to Bertino, they're LDS. Like, look, Mormon missionaries are not 12 years old. Like, I think they lowered the age to 18, but like, they are functional adults. Like, they don't hand out pamphlets. You only know these are Mormons because that's their name in the credits. But yeah, they look like Christian evangelicalist.
Not the stereotype, but the white shirts and all of that. The look.
Yeah, they're kids though.
I thought they were Jehovah's Witnesses. I've had children Jehovah's Witnesses come to my door. I didn't see in the credits that they were Mormon.
Yeah, be that as it may, we don't even know that they're religious affiliated, but they're dressed identically and they are pausing in front of a vehicle whose windshield has been smashed in almost in a heart shape. And the front door is wide open. We see little remnants of things that are going to become important to the story. A ring box, rose petals on the floor. And yes, just a hint of splatter as we hear their 911 emergency phone call asking for help. That there are bodies there. And then we jump into a scene that already was going badly. Like, it didn't need home invaders for this night to be absolutely horrible for this man, James, here. We see his ringless hand gripping the steering wheel as he has to go back to the home he decorated with romantic gestures that will be not celebrated this evening by the woman he proposed to. I absolutely love this opening.
Yeah, what a harsh thing, right? This movie does not have a lot of dialogue. Even during these opening scenes, there's not a lot of dialogue. But the body language of Scott Speedman and Liv Tyler here, and just the rose petals, the strange silences, this is a painful, painful opening of awkwardness.
I have to ask, because I think this is kind of Liv Tyler's film, but what is she doing? Like, I feel like we got Armageddon and then Lord of the Rings and I don't know, then she kind of disappeared.
She had a kid and took several years off from acting. This was her first film when she decided she wanted to come back and act. And she said that it felt like a lot of time had passed because she came back and now she was working for a director much younger than her.
Not only that, but she was getting a divorce. She had apparently married the lead singer of Space Hog. I don't know if you remember that. They were kind of like a glam rock band from the 90s.
No, I don't remember them.
Yeah, I guess she felt like she could do better than that. Like, it's not the 90s anymore. I need a new husband. And so the idea that there's this marital tension probably matched her vibe here. She was probably could relate to this character instantly. And again, the acting challenge here, not a lot of dialogue, not a lot of backstory. It's almost like a Beckett play or something. Like, you're watching these characters sit in silence for so long. Every word they say has to, like, land and mean something and speak to something. And so that's the challenge here of, like, figuring out what happened with this couple. Why is it gone so bad?
During this first half, I'm really intrigued. I think it's really clever what they've done here, where they walk in, you see rose petals. Oh, that's a good thing. And she's like, oh, when did you have time to do this? And you're like, oh, okay, there's some tension here. And we'll get a little flashback to a proposal. But I don't know why she didn't say yes. Like, I don't know anything about these characters after this intro. Like, this is my trouble. Like,
trouble.
Yes. Look, I don't want anyone to be murdered in their home or murdered anywhere. That's bad. But in a movie, in fiction, you create characters that you care about or you have some kind of vested interest in. And I will never care about these two. Spoiler, I'll never care about anyone in this film.
Oh, interesting. Okay, because I feel like you've been given just enough to feel for both of them. How awkward would it be to be like, I was just at my friend's wedding and then suddenly my date sprung this on me and I had to like turn it into this ugly, like, yeah, I don't want to. Apparently they were going to go on a road trip and it was going to be a fun thing. And now I need to just return the rental and be done with it. And I guess we can't even see each other. Like, they're breaking up. Like, what was going to be a fun road trip is now a breakup scene.
And I get all that. I like the setup. There's just no payoff for me. Again, with Straw Dogs, we see a couple and that home invasion like comes to mean something about their relationship as they go through that. Here, I'm looking at them. Okay, there's some tension. Is this going to bring them together? Is it going to reveal why she couldn't say yes to that proposal? Like, even in the midst of trying to survive killers, they can't get along and they fight. Like, that's a jumping point. And then I need something more. And
you get it.
Nope. That's all we're going to know about these ones.
No, that's the entire arc of this film is that they start, especially her, thinking she doesn't need other people and they're going to die knowing that it only matters that they're together and she's going to die wearing that ring and holding his hand. This is the story of her realizing that all she needed was him.
I don't know. If three people are trying to kill me, I would want Arnold. I want Sly. I'll take anyone. Ronda Rousey, anyone. I'll accept their hand in marriage to get me out of that situation.
You'd accept Scott Speedman, the hunk from Felicity?
I think he was better known at this point as the werewolf boy in the not Twilight, a werewolf and vampire movies, Underworld.
Oh, I only know him as the hunk from Felicity that Carrie Russell followed to college because he said something nice to her and she turned that into a whole imaginary romance.
No, at this point he had horror movie cred. He had done two of those films and they were popular around this time. So people would have known him from that. He might be seen as an equally big star. But now I think people still remember Liv Tyler. I don't know that anyone knows who this guy is. And so he looks like a chump. You're just watching a guy who wasn't good enough for Liv Tyler trying to get through the evening.
Join Space Hog, dude. Yeah. Join the club.
You know, and he's trying to be nice. Like, he's being about as non-assholish as you can while still being really mad about this. Like, he's helping her take off the dress. He's not breaking anything.
He made her a fire, yeah.
He's doing much better than I would in the same circumstance. I'll give him that.
Well, he wants to get out of there. Understandably, immediately it's like, I'm not going on a road trip with you. I'm not going to look at you. When she tries to sit there and say, I'm just not ready, he's like, I don't even want to hear this. I don't want to hear your explanations. I'm so humiliated. I did the whole officer and a gentleman thing. I picked you up and gave you this ring. I can't return it. Like, I don't know what jeweler doesn't accept receipts, but like, he's stuck.
I don't know what kind of jeweler does accept receipts. Usually you bought it, it's yours when it comes to those high-end items.
Really? I have no jewelry, so totally new to me.
At least the ones I bought. I've only bought two, but the ones I've bought.
I don't know. Maybe he had it sized for her. I don't know. You know, she should.
Well, you have every ring sized.
Yeah. Well, I mean, don't you, like, normally in proposal, like, you get it fitted later?
No, you get it all, like, ready to go when you go to propose. It's got to fit.
So he should have known, right, that the answer was going to be yes. Like, he was maybe, I don't want to say who's at fault, but maybe he had a different impression about what the relationship was.
You can't say who's at fault. We don't know anything about them.
I have to agree with Jacob on that. I mean, like, how long have they been together? Obviously, quite a while if they're going to a wedding together and staying at his father's cabin together. But, you know, does she think there's somebody else? Does she think she can do better? Does she have bad parents that she just doesn't believe in marriage as the right thing for her? What is her reason? You know what, though? I kind of go with this whole blank slate, you can project your own reason onto it, because the performances they give, and I don't usually like Liv Tyler.
No, she's good in this. She's the best thing in this.
She really is good here, and I'm feeling the hurt. I'm feeling sorrow. I'm feeling a mourning for this relationship. And it's not like it's completely over. You know, he's calling his friend Mike to come pick him up. He needs to get out of there. But they're still going to fuck on this furniture.
Well, that's the interesting turning point. It was a clear breakup. It was, I'm getting out of here. I don't want to look at you. I'm done. But she basically, the way that I read the scene is, she comes back and kind of smooths it over about, like, it's not you, it's me, is what I hear her saying. That, you know, like, she's not ready. And then is giving every indication when they put on the country record and all of that, that she's still thinking of him romantically. And so, if there was no home invasion, would this be back on track? Would they be off on a road trip? We can only project, but I would say that yes, this was a relationship in crisis that was just about to correct itself, and then someone comes a-knocking for Tamara.
At 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Not a good time to have a visitor.
They refer to this mask as Dollface, although she's not even wearing her mask yet.
Yeah, they've unscrewed the light bulb on the porch light, so you can't see her face.
Gemma Ward is a supermodel. This is some kind of joke that,
really?
Like, you hire a supermodel and then never show her face.
I did look at the credits afterwards because I noticed none of these strangers we ever see their faces, even when they take off the mask. I'm like, do we have some fun cameos here? Oh, no, I don't know any of these people.
I watched all the bonus features on the Shout Factory disc here. They had a 20-minute interview with Gemma Ward. They had a 20-minute interview with Kip Weeks. They talk about tryouts. I'm like, when I'm watching this movie, I just thought they were stunt people, okay?
Right.
None of them come back for the sequel. Why would you go through this trouble? Just get whoever can do the stunts in a mask. Gemma Ward didn't even do some of the stunts. She's like, well, in this scene, I was a guy because the stunt coordinator did it in a wig. I'm like, why did they hire you?
She just wanted to be in a movie, probably. My guess is, like, this is her first work in a professional shoot. Her agent lied to her and told her that she was going to be more important than she was. Or at least she was going to have to use different parts of herself to sell the movie. Because, again, supermodel, we will have most of her, all of her face and most of her body hidden. Throughout this, she just becomes a scary mask, a visage.
It's probably worth saying, though, the end of the movie was supposed to show all these killers' faces.
Interesting.
And we were going to get a good look at them. And it was in editing, the editor said, yeah, I think it's better if we just cut around the faces and not show them.
Mm.
So maybe you hire the actors because of that moment. You want them to be there. But I still think, like, if you look at John Carpenter's Halloween, when they take off Michael Myers' mask and there's that quote-unquote angel underneath, that's not the guy who's under that mask the rest of the time. I don't think you need a supermodel to run around with the baby mask on.
Just have her show up for a day. Yeah.
Maybe the director wanted a supermodel. I mean, there's going to be lots of reasons why you hired the supermodel, the babe, for the bit part.
I don't know. The director was saying, you know, I don't really write with people in mind, but I really thought Liv Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
And it made me think, yeah, so would I.
At any rate, this scene is totally scary as hell. I mean, this, like, just gets under my skin when she's like, yeah, 4 a.m. asking about someone here. You got the wrong house. Okay, see you later. Like, just all about this does feel Manson family, right? Like, you're scoping this place out and something bad is about to go down. See you later. The way she looks at Liv Tyler and says, see you later, I would be like, we're getting in the car right now. I love you. We're getting married. Let's go to Vegas.
Yeah, see you later is a scary goodbye from a stranger.
Yeah, and I agree. At this point, like, this is super scary, super good. Like, it feels real natural. It feels different than your typical, you know, slasher or even home invasion film. Like, it does have a different vibe, and I'm really into it at the beginning here.
I agree. And while it is spooky when somebody knocks on your door at that time of night, it could just be a drunk person, right? It could just be somebody at the wrong door. See you later could just be goodbye. Sometimes I have a weird time. How do you say goodbye to somebody you know you're never going to see again? Like, when I left my last job, what do I say to people? See you around. No, I won't. But...
But the fact that James, like, he'll kind of step outside and he realizes the light bulb was unscrewed and he puts it back in and the light turns on. Again, there's just something menacing. It feels like that was deliberate.
And they even have a moment of, like, morality of, like, should we go get her and help? Like, is she lost? Maybe we can help her. But she's just creepy enough that we're like, nah, she'll figure it out. It's 4 a.m. and I don't need to add this to my plate. But it was a mood killer. They were making out, like, pants were dropping. And now she's like, I need cigarettes. And so he's going to go out. And now we get an even more escalating terror. She's going to be by herself when this camera seeker comes back a knocking again.
Can I just say, though, I am so glad that they didn't do the, we're in a remote cabin, there's no cell signal thing. There is cell signal here. Now, this was 2005. Cell phone batteries did suck terribly, so they can use that one.
No way. My cell phone battery lasted forever compared to this iPhone. It would last days without getting plugged in. My little flip phone.
Mine always had to be plugged in, so I was with her when she was making the call and had to, like, stand next to the wall with the charger plugged in and everything. I liked that.
I didn't even have a cell phone, so wasn't looking at judging her for her flip phone or not, but I'm a huge Joanna Newsom fan. I have always thought, like there's something very folky and charming about her. I never thought of Sproutin' the Bean as a scary song. This is the movie that makes you really, like, see her scratchy vocals and harp as something menacing. Like, there's, when she puts on that record, it's like, ooh, this, it's the idea that you're taking something familiar, which, again, this house is not familiar to her, but a home typically is a place of safety, and coloring it in the night using the camera stylings that they're doing. Again, this is a first-time director. His command is remarkable. And maybe I should credit the editors as well, but they are putting together this movie in a way with the sound design and the editing. The lingering dread is overwhelming.
What's really effective for me and what I appreciate about this, I got a lot of compliments during the first half of this film, guys. Like, it's not going to be a hate fest for me, but what I really liked, and they're going to go back on this later, but it's during the climax, but we'll see the man in the mask and he's like standing back in the shadows and we just see him in the corner.
In the kitchen, yes.
Holy shit. When he showed up, I screamed. I literally, in my living room, made an audible gasp.
And this is why it's so effective, because in any other typical horror film, there would have been a done, like we'd gone for the jump scare. Here in this, they do that once during the climax, but most of the time, it's just, you'll see people running around in the background. And I love that. I find that very effective. That's scary as hell, that you just notice something in the corner of your eye and then focus on it. Like, great. I wish more horror was like that. Big compliment to this one.
He's out of focus. He's in the shadows. It could be a clock on the wall, right? But he's wearing that white mask. She never notices him. He doesn't rush out at her. This is not the setup of a scare. This is just eerie atmosphere. And I didn't even catch that. I watched this movie twice for this review. The first time, I didn't catch it. Second time, I'm like, was that face there last time? Because I watched two cuts. And it was, but it's explaining how they were in there to smash the phone. Sometimes I wondered, were they cheating? How did these people get in the house? When did they get in the house? But if you watch it and see all these little background details, it is very solid.
And Jacob, you say you wish more horror was like this. This is the era of found footage. Now, this movie is not found footage, but that is the technique of found footage horror, that you're watching something that does not have a soundtrack, that is artless in its composition and its presentation, and something is going to come from the background or a sound is going to happen. The idea that it's not the monster in full frame, but the what's going on in the periphery or just out of frame, that's what scares you. Paranormal Activity will trade on this a lot. We'll cover that series when we get to Gold Level, but this was the era of that horror. Paranormal Activity was very popular at this time.
Yeah, and it helps that this is a home invasion, because if it was like a ghost or something, it could still be scary, but I think this plays more on real-life fears. And I like that it's not just the cell phone ends up getting smashed. We saw earlier the chimney flue wasn't open, smoke started pouring in, and Kristen had to undo the smoke detector, and then that was on the ground. They make sure we know it's on the ground. I appreciate that. We get a couple of establishing shots, and then she like turns around, and it's been put on a chair, like... Again, all this kind of cat and mouse stuff, like all these just little differences that she's starting to notice as she's looking around, I think is very effective.
Oh my God. Yeah, I want to point out, we're 25 minutes into this movie, and it's been amazing to realize where we're at. Like, you could say almost nothing has happened, and yet I feel like, yeah, when I see that fire alarm, I want to scream. Like, it is like the best he's calling from inside the house moment ever. You know, like, we always get that in these kinds of movies of like Black Christmas established, like the killer's in the house. This is the moment when you realize it, which makes when she finally realizes and sees this person and they're outside, the audience has a different interpretation of that than she does. She thinks, oh my God, there's people trying to get in my house. But we go, he's already been in the house, and now he's outside the house. This is someone playing games. This is someone with a sense of humor. This is Ghostface calling Drew Barrymore and quizzing her on her favorite scary movies.
Yeah, exactly. Cat and mouse. They're going to be playing with their victims, which is interesting. You don't, well, you know, like Freddy might play with his victims, play video games with them or something as they're the character. But, you know, usually it's, you don't see this kind of thing. That Michael Myers bangs into the house and just stabs you. So, yeah, again, it's reminding me a little bit of Funny Games where it's about the psychological torture, too.
Right.
And might I just say, I was given a little bit of shit for not liking the first part of Straw Dogs very much, but this I'm loving. You can have a 90-minute or 80-minute home invasion without having a lot of bullshit drama set up initially. Here, I got what I need from these two characters. The home invasion is not motivated by anything. It's not that she pissed off the townies in this place, and it's not that she has an argument with the person fixing her garage. Don't need any of it.
You don't think it's Mormon Tara, a man with two wives coming in on a couple that can't get hitched?
You think this is Mormon polygamists coming in to get them?
I mean, I'm having a laugh. I don't know what it is, but I think the invitation when something is this ambiguous, I'm sure there are people that have written very dense papers about what this all could mean. And
I was stuck on 9/11 as I usually am and thinking that the randomness of death and
sure.
That people were coming in and feels like we did have an explosion of home invasion films in the aughts. And I got thinking about the remake of Last House on the Left, the remake of Funny Games, The Strangers, You're Next. This is a horror movie response to 9/11 when terrorists invaded our country and killed people for no reason.
The invasion of home.
The other was coming into our home.
Yeah, America had never been attacked in that way on 9/11. And so the idea that, yes, here in this safe place, again, it's not so safe for her because this is not her house. It's his, you know, we've seen like he has a growth chart on the wall. Like he grew up here. She doesn't know it. Now she's going to be like, I need to get him here. He can make it safe again. This man can protect me. But there are, I think at this point we realize there are three. There was the girl asking for Tamara, who is now wearing a doll face mask. There is this masked man that has been in and out moving the fire alarms and ruining the phones. And then when the front door opens, just very briefly, we see the character that is in the credits described as Pinup Girl. Do we know why she was given that name?
That mask looks more like a flapper than a pinup.
I was thinking her outfit.
Yes.
I was thinking Betty Boop or some 20s Hollywood star. Clara Bow.
But yeah, this is really tense. And I think this movie does a great job of holding and escalating the tension. And in so many movies, they say, you know, you got to break it. You got to have a comic relief moment, right? You can't keep people tense the whole time. You've got to give them a laugh. You got to give them some release. And then you bring it back up a few notches again. And no, that's not what they do. They keep it tense and make it tenser. And she is there completely alone. She's grabbing the knife. She's trying to figure out a way to defend herself. She's trying to call James, and it is just, I am with her on this emotional journey of panic.
And for all those people trying to body shame Liv Tyler about being too skinny, she's too big to get under the bed. I love that detail. Like, she's trying to crawl under the bed, doesn't even fit. There's nothing she can do. She ends up hurting her hand, smashing the lamp because she can't figure out how to turn it off or unplug it. It's getting really bad for her. The release, as you say, is that what ends up coming through the door is James. He comes back. He doesn't believe her. He's like, I don't know where my phone is. I think it's in the car, but your phone was not taken. This is all ridiculous. And the director slyly cuts to insert shots where the phone is in the fireplace and all of that. But it will take him a beat before he realizes that what she was saying over the phone is in fact true.
It's when he goes out for his own phone and realizes, hey, somebody smashed the damn thing.
Yeah, someone grabs him on the shoulder and...
That shot bothers me. That one shot where somebody reaches his neck.
Yeah.
That is the only moment of this film that I don't find believable.
How'd they run away so fast and not be seen?
Yeah, I mean, he jumps and flips and sees nothing. It's the only moment I think this movie cheats.
Okay, well, let me dig into that. By having the... And I think it was Dollface, touch him on the shoulder and run away. Maybe she's just an Olympic runner gone bad. You know, after you win your medals, what else do you have to do but kill people, I guess?
Sure, that could be the backstory in this film because we're not going to get one. Why not?
For some reason, I just wouldn't be so scared of murderous Simone Biles.
Dude, she would like flip kick you so hard.
Yeah, I think you would.
I would not mess with her.
You don't want to admit it, but you would definitely be cringing if Simone Biles came to kill you. But my question is, are you thinking Supernatural? Are these people in masks or are these unstoppable Freddy Kruegers, Michael Myers? They can't be killed. They're not human. They're the shape.
I prefer to think of them only as human. Human on human is the scariest thing of all. And so the fact that they drive a pickup truck at things, I don't know too many demonics that would choose that mode of transport. So I thought that this was just completely human. And that's why that moment bugged me, because that did seem like something you'd do in an Insidious film.
Yeah, I never took these as supernatural. Again, I think I more or less get the style and what they're going for. I just don't like it. But I take it as, yeah, these are very human characters. They obviously have like a method down, like they're going to write on windows. Like they've done all this before, it feels like. Maybe the next film, I haven't seen it, we'll get some answers how they came up with this. But
hello, 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 hello.
Yeah, it just feels like this is a routine and that they've developed somehow. But yeah, I never take them as demonic, that these are killers of some sort. That have this whole, they like to torture and play with their victims.
We've seen enough slasher movies to know that usually the template is, even when we're told they're human beings, they're super beings. They can withstand more pain, torture, and, you know, attacks than anything. And so the touching and running away to me says that these things are not on the same level, that this couple is going to be outmatched, that they don't have a hope of being able to stop what they're up against. So, all right, James knows, and they proceed inside. He wants to get the gun. A moment, one of the few that we have of them as a couple, is that he obviously talked himself up as some kind of hunter that went out to the forest with his dad. And in fact, he doesn't even know how to wield this shotgun.
Yeah, he's not sure how to load it.
Yeah, like all of that. Again, it's crumbling the idea that they can be safe as long as they stay inside the house. That's usually how this works, right? You got to keep them out. And as long as you keep them out, you're safe. But now, this is a couple that doesn't like each other very much. This is a guy that's not very good with a gun. My trust in him to be able to protect her, it's plummeting rapidly.
And they're already in. We don't know quite how they get in. She did lock the front door. Were they coming in a window? Were they coming in a back door? We're not going to find that out. But yes, it is. You can't keep them out of the house.
Right. Yes, that's the joke, is that they've already been inside. They already have done all of this, and that they probably know secrets that even James doesn't know. So, again, can they be killed? When he finally gets a shot off with his shotgun, their masked man is coming through the front door with an axe. I think it would be surprising to think that he had already killed one by the 40-minute mark, but Did you think that a shotgun could take these people out? If they're people, you must think that that's a possibility.
Yeah, I thought, again, straw dogs. Like, these are people versus people. Like, you could definitely shoot them and they'll die.
I don't think a home invasion film would work as well if the person invading was Jason.
I mean, isn't that what Halloween 1 is?
Yeah, I mean, again, that's, I guess, what I'm really asking is, am I watching Halloween 3 with, like, you know, Michael and his two sisters that decided to be killers as well? Or am I watching Straw Dogs?
I'm pretty sure we're not going to Stonehenge.
Yeah. I feel like if this were a slasher movie, there would be a lot more gore and blood, and you want a body count. You would have this be the entire wedding party. It wouldn't just be a bridesmaid and her date. Here, because it is just about the fears of how killers can get in your home, it does feel more like Straw Dogs, though without the drama, without the characterization that helps you understand how this could be interpreted metaphorically. That's what feels weird. It has a slasher thinness to the characterization, but no love for the violence.
No, there's not enough people, as you pointed out. And that's the thing that got me, is I'm thinking about this movie with the now playing goggles on, especially on my second viewing. And I'm like, you're not going to have a big body count. There's only two victims and three attackers. I couldn't remember this movie. I hadn't seen it in 13 years. I'm like, do they kill one or two of the attackers along the way? I mean, I remembered, I thought, a very down ending. So I was trying to just place how many bodies can you have in a slasher film like this. It's not going to be very many. And so you're not going to have a whole lot of gore. The fact that this is rated R, you think it probably could have gotten away with a PG-13.
The first piece of real gore that we get isn't even because of the strangers. It's because of James.
Yeah, but if we needed a body count, we've forgotten about Mike. But we're at the halfway point in this movie.
Bring in Dennis from It's Always Sunny.
Yeah. I was like, where do I know this guy? Like, not from horror movies. No, he is on a FX sitcom. He's kind of like everyone's least favorite in that show. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's beloved.
He's such a douchebag. Yeah, he's not a great character.
He comes blowing in here. What is he thinking? I mean, he got a call. His friend said, I need to pick up. It didn't go well. She's not going to marry me. Read between the lines. If you came there and you saw, like, the windshield cracked and the door open and signs of rose petals and violence, maybe you would think that Jimmy had, like, snapped. You didn't marry me and I'm going to kill you.
That's exactly what I was kind of thinking. Not kill, but you've seen Tiger Woods' wife beating his car with golf clubs. That's what I would think, is he maybe took out some rage.
Yeah, except Mike's car gets attacked too, like when he pulls up. That's kind of why he's on edge and picks up a crowbar or something as a weapon.
Right, but he doesn't know from where.
So I don't know if he thought that was his friend attacking him or not.
Yeah, that happens a few times. At one time, they're standing by the window and it's not shots being fired through, but something's hitting it.
No, I think they're just throwing rocks or something. It doesn't make sense, yeah.
Yeah, violence is coming from dark crevices and the shadows and you don't know what it is and how much it could hurt you. And so my feeling is he comes in, they're blasting the Merle Haggard really loud. So he's saying, Jimmy, 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 and can't be heard. The record ends. And by that point, he's coming to the bedroom thinking, oh my God, lovers spat. Like, they may have both killed each other. Like, he is not thinking they got home invaded. He's thinking, I'm going to have to, like, O.J. Simpson this and, like, ride my friend off to, you know, somewhere where he can hide out.
I thought for sure, though, I mean, when he's walking through the hallways, you see the masked man behind him.
Yeah, that was great.
And again, suspense. You think, oh God, this guy's behind you. You can't hear him because the music's so loud. Turn around, dude.
You also think he's going to turn around. Like, he's almost turning around.
I know. I'm like, this movie got me to be that person in the theater, behind you, turn around!
Totally.
And then it's not even the masked man who kills him, because James had been hiding in a closet with that shotgun, waiting for one of the strangers to come to the door, sees a body in the door, and does what I would do. There's a person, shoot them. Oh fuck, I killed Mike.
Right. And this is a common home invasion where the innocent person inside, the victim, ends up becoming the aggressor. But I don't know. I don't really hold it against James. It doesn't feel like the same kind of transformation that we see of Dustin Hoffman. But how shitty. Yeah, you can imagine your best friend being blown away because you were trigger happy. You didn't even know how to work the gun. You shot it off. And if you had just taken half a second more, you knew he wasn't wearing a mask. Just look at his face. You would have known.
Yeah, but if you look at the way they frame it and light it, when he walks in the doorway, you don't see the face. The face is in darkness. He just sees a body.
Mm-hmm. So now it's time to split up. Like, they got one plan, and that is there's a radio in the barn, and James is going to get it. My plan would be, like, take Mike's wheels, right? There's a functional Jeep. We need to get out of here.
Oh, I'm sure they trashed that by now, haven't they?
When James goes outside, it is not on fire yet. And it is only because he gets the idea that he could kill one of these people that he gets jumped from behind by Masked Man, and we don't see him for the next 15 minutes. And then it's Kristen, Liv Tyler, who, a lot of cat and mouse stuff here, where, like, Masked Man is coming up behind her. Does she see it? Does she know? She ends up running and tripping and hurting her leg. And anytime you get the sense that these trio could take her out, but it's their fun, it's their entertainment to watch her try and get to the radio.
When she falls, I'm like, okay, now we're in a horror movie trope. I'm enjoying this movie so much for being, I'll dare say, you know, not in the way you guys would use this word, but I think it's a little bit more arty in the way it's going because...
Oh, definitely, yeah.
It's not following the pattern. It's allowing for some more nebulousness. And so when I see something like she falls down while running, I'm like, oh, come on.
Well, and then she's got to do like the Last Girl crawl. Like she can't quite walk and she's got to drag herself to the garage.
I've stumbled many times in my life. I can be kind of klutzy, but I've never like hurt myself so bad that I couldn't run from killers. And this does only seem to happen in horror movies. It does become sort of this cliche that, okay, they're going to do that one.
This is where it starts to lose me because we'll see her. She gets to that CB. She's calling for help. Someone answers. And then I get confused between Dollface and Pinup Girl.
Pinup Girl gets the whacking.
My problem was I didn't realize there's two different females until very late into the film. So all my notes were just Dollface.
They both could be a doll. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we see Pinup. She smashes that CB radio and then Kristen's got to like crawl out, and I get that they're playing with her, but now it seems like even though she's like crawling at times, like they're looking for her, like they've lost track of her and they don't know where she is sometimes. I'm like, it doesn't make sense. She's injured. There's three of them. They've been watching her the whole time.
I think that's a total mind game. When Masked Man is like walking into the room and like looking the other way and never turns around to see her.
Oh no, that part. Yeah, he definitely knows she's hiding in the pantry.
Yeah, I feel like they're doing that a lot here. Of like, I mean, come on, she's whimpering and limping and there's plenty of exterior light around this cabin. So like, she's visible. She's quite obvious and easy to keep track of. And so I think that they're giving her the false hope that she can get away, that she can, yeah, at this point, run back into the house and they can kill the power and play some hiding in the closet games. Very Halloween at this point.
And I did wonder, again, because my memory was a lot of records were played in this film. That was my one memory of The Strangers. And so when we see the Masked Man walk into the kitchen looking for her, it sounds like he's wheezing. Now, look, that mask looks very hot, so I guess he's just out of breath. But I was wondering, I'm like, oh, is he like have some kind of terminal disease and he's dying? And like, that's why they're doing this. Like, at this point, I really want some answers about what their motives are. Why torture this couple?
You would expect it. I fully agree. At this point, you would expect one of them to be dead or unmasked, or at the very least, a sense about like, oh, Liv Tyler's going to turn on the radio and find out three maniacs escaped from the asylum or something. You know, the dribble of a backstory would be happening by this point. Because we're an hour in, this movie's pretty short. There's only about 20 more minutes to go, and 7 minutes of that are very slow crawling credits. So there's, I don't want to use the word stalling, but they're sustaining this moment of tension without adding any information to it.
This is the moment where I feel the movie drags. When Scott Speedman's kind of out of the picture for a while, Liv is running to the radio, Liv is hiding in the closet. It doesn't feel like there's escalation anymore. It does feel a little like treading water.
Well, we've seen it all now. We know there's only three. It'd be different if there was a new mass person even, but there's only three of them. They could potentially be impossible to kill. I mean, again, I haven't given up on the idea that even if she got the knife in them or got the shotgun, that it would have the desired effect. Again, I'm not really sure if this is home invasion or horror. I guess what you could say is I'm starting to see scenes that I've seen in other movies like Halloween, where she's in the closet and will he find her? And no, it's actually Pinup Girl that finds her. And
that's where we get the one big jump scare sting, like when she jumps through that pantry door and attacks her. Like, that's when we get the dong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But familiar. This feels like stuff that I would see in other horror movies. And maybe all of this is stuff that's familiar. But up to this point, it felt very fresh. And in the way that it used sound design specifically, camera and sound design have really sustained the tension. I think you guys are right to say at this point, maybe it's losing a little bit, because at what point are they going to kill her, right? What is this all going to be for? If they could have her at any time, how long will this be entertaining for them is really the question.
Yeah, she's going to eventually ask one of them, why are you doing this to us? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, you were home. Which, no, that's how you picked your victim. That's not the why you're doing this. Like,
no, but why are you doing this to us was the question, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that doesn't tell the why. Because you're home? Like, well, why would you attack anyone that was home?
You could look at that in two different ways. One, are we to see this as poor people that are attacking people that have a summer home? Is it a class issue? Wealthy and have-nots?
I was wondering that. I thought that might be a reveal.
I don't think that that's what it is. I think what they're saying is, in this, because they've been so playful, for lack of a better word, up to this point, is that they would fuck with anybody. Like, it's really not about who you are or that you deserve what you're going to get. In horror movies, we tend to assign that label of like, well, you're not a virgin, or you did something karmically, even if you don't quote unquote deserve to be executed, there's some reason for it. The horror of this is there is none. We just could get in. And so we did.
And I guess that kind of nihilism, it definitely could work. If I cared maybe about this couple, if I saw something beautiful, or they were on the mend and falling in love again, and it just gets destroyed because, oh, you were home, that could work. It doesn't work for me the way it's shown in this film, because I don't know what their motivation is. You could do a lot of things that'd be interesting. I want to know. It's more than just to me, because it is so thin, it just feels like here's an exercise in a home invasion film. Like, we came up with some cool designs for masks. We came up with a cool way to have people moving around in the background. That's spooky. Like, there's a lot of technical things I like, but ultimately, I don't need to care about Freddy, like be emotionally invested in Freddy or Jason or Michael Myers, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's a family. I don't know a whole lot about them, but it's a parody of the American family. And so, like, I get what you're doing with your slashers there. And here, I end up not caring about anyone in this film.
Oh, I'm the exact opposite. What story are you going to tell me that I haven't heard before? Oh, my parents were mean. Oh, I was molested.
That's the writer's job to surprise us and come up with something.
Oh, but I think the writer did a better job by not doing that. Think about this. The director even talked about this on the commentary. There are so many deaths that are unexplained, so many murders, and maybe eventually we'll find out what the motive was or who the killer was, but a lot of people get stabbed and we don't know why, and maybe they don't know why, and I love the ambiguousness. I love the nihilism of this film. It's what makes it special. If they took off their masks and were like, you're the haves and we're the have-nots, fuck that movie.
Well, no, it doesn't have to be that dumb, though. Again, the writer's job is to create something interesting. And the reason I loved Fincher's Zodiac was because of that nihilism. And you can't know. But again, that was based in real life. Here, they're trying to tell us this is real life. I don't believe it. I don't believe any serial killers would. Again, they're leaving a lot of evidence around. They're writing stuff. They're like, maybe they are supernatural, Stuart, the more I think about it, because if you're trying to make me put them into realism and reality and all that, it doesn't work as well. No.
Right. Doesn't make any sense. They would get caught. They wouldn't be able to get through too many houses. I have confidence in CSI and even the police force that would be operating out here in the boonies. They would be able to pick up these people. They wouldn't be able to kill everyone in America in this joyride mask-wearing fashion. It doesn't have plausibility. Ultimately, what's being exposed by this ending, in my interpretation, is it is more about the horror of it and not the home invasion of it. by which I mean it is a supernatural explanation. These are just represent doom. And yeah, I'm siding with Arnie on this. Normally, I would probably sign with you, Jacob, but this movie has been so well crafted in elevating the suspense. It proves to me that I don't need to have a why in order to feel the terror of the end.
I think it's more scary without the why.
I know we're getting a sequel to this. I haven't seen it. But would you want a whole franchise of The Strangers six films in and never know anything more about them? Like, to me, that just, oh, now they're just snuff films. It's technical exercises to see how they torture people and murder them.
I wouldn't know how you would make a sequel to this. I agree. What I liked about it was that it felt, yes, unique unto itself. The only thing I could point to was Funny Games, a very similar idea in that you had killers with no motive who, again, just gleefully just threw out ideas about, yeah, maybe we're gay killers. But, you know, they basically played out the role play of every slasher home invasion we'd ever seen before and ultimately says, does it even really matter in the end? Like, is there any explanation we could give you to explain our cruelty to you and why we are so scary?
But the Funny Games goes a bit surreal at the end, and there's some commentary going on there, which I don't see it the same thing as these killers who I know nothing about.
Fair enough. It breaks the fourth wall in a big way. So yeah. We'll cover that movie in the book. You can get the book soon.
Yes, I had to watch it and write a big review for
it. Well, you'll get the book soon. We're hoping in the next 4 months and a different movie. For this one, all I'm really saying is I accept fully the premise that they've pulled some kind of Beckett, like existential, like Waiting for Godot, like we've learned nothing. We spent time with characters we don't know who did nothing and are now dead. Like it's the ultimate existential slasher movie.
For me, you know, you talk about the supernatural possibility with them. What I took this as, you know, you're thinking, what do you do with a sequel? I took this as like, maybe this was their first time killing it. Correct me if I'm wrong, didn't the Manson family only kill once as well?
These people are well-versed in what they're doing. Like, they know how to scare people.
There was Bobby Boussoulet who had killed somebody else, and there were different murders. And you know what? There's even conspiracies that link them to other famous murderers, so difficult to say. But yes, the three that broke in and killed Sharon Tate did not go around and go to the next house on the left. You know, like, yeah, that was a one-off.
Yeah, I was just, but to me, the fact that the fingerprints aren't there, all of this, that they're not so worried about it, tells me these aren't regular serial killers. Because you're home, I mean, there are those cases, right? Of, I seem to see it more with kids than adults, but I just wanted to kill somebody, so I took my friend and killed them just to see that.
There's always something underlying that, though.
And there's the end twist, too. Like, after this is all over with, we have the couple executed. Their story ends. I think that what we've been hoping is that because we haven't seen too much of them, they've, of course, got to live and, like, go and live this life that we don't know much about them. The fact that we never will learn about them and that they're just executed, it's harsh.
Now, did you guys see the rated or the unrated cut? Because there's really only one difference, and it's here at the end.
I don't know.
I saw whatever Netflix has.
Right.
In the rated cut, the killers stab them, and we cut, and they go away, and you think they're both dead. In the unrated cut, the killers stab them, and then the killers watch as Liv Tyler crawls down the hallway, gets to Mike, dead body Mike, pulls out Mike's cell phone and tries to call for help.
Unrated cut. I know the scene you're talking about. Yeah, I saw that scene.
No, I didn't see this. Finish, please. What happened?
She gets to the phone and she tries calling and then the man in the mask just takes the phone away from her.
Yeah, it's really kind of an inconsequential scene. I actually prefer the rated version because when those little Mormon boys come in and she wakes up and screams, you have no reason to believe why she'd be alive. If you saw this scene, you knew that the killers left her alive when they left.
That sounds right to me. I don't think I needed an extended moment of maybe she's going to make it. Again, that just seems like a cruel tease of like, oh yeah, maybe she'll get away because you need a final girl. Nope. But the reason why you know that they've probably done this before, and they definitely will do it again, Arnie, is that they had the opportunity to take out those Mormon boys. They saw them at the road.
I thought they were going to.
They pull over, and Dollface gets out and wants a pamphlet. And, you know, they ask, are you a sinner? She gets back in, and Pinup Girl tells her, it'll be easier next time.
That's true. There is that line. But the fact that she says that, again, does imply this is the first time.
No, well, or that she's a new recruit.
Yes, for her.
Maybe a better title for this film would be Sister Knives. Because maybe there is something to that polygamy going on here. This is the new recruit.
I do think you could read it in there. Again, the fact that the Mormon character's in here and the pamphlet, and it seems to be what's scaring Liv Tyler awake. It's like, she's not horrified that like the killers are back. She's horrified that
the missionaries are here.
Missionaries are here with religious material. Get out of my house. I've been through enough.
But have you been through enough? Jacob Stewart, do you recommend The Strangers? Jacob.
I think it's kind of obvious where I'm going. I think technically this film is really well put together. You're telling me this is a first-time director? That's shocking because it is the kind of horror I want where it's not jump scares, where it's just things moving in the background that you might or might not notice and it creeps up on you. Like, I really enjoyed that during this first half of the film as I'm getting to know, okay, here's the layout and here's the characters and, oh, I'm getting little hints of, you know, something going on with this relationship between James and Kristen. Like, will it or won't it work out in the end? Will they come together because of this home invasion? Will it tear them more apart? Like, what are we going to learn from this extreme circumstance? And then we learn nothing. And again, maybe that's the point, that there's nothing to learn. It's all nihilism, but it makes me feel kind of empty by the end of it. Like, I don't care about whether Kristen dies when she screams. Like, is she dead? Is she still alive? I don't care because I don't know anything about her. And again, in real life, I don't want people to be murdered, but in fiction, I want it to reveal something and mean something. And the fact that these strangers have no motivation, that they're just killers. They're really well versed in their methods, it seems. And I feel like there's got to be something more interesting under the surface. Maybe the director, writer, like he had some idea and it just, he wanted to go with it this way. Again, it's not a bad film. And I could see Stewart, well, that's why I asked if you saw the second half of this film, because yes, if the projector died during the first half of this film, I'd be super excited and want to see the rest of it. And then because I just learned nothing about the situation, again, it almost just feels kind of like a snuff film. Like, we're just going to watch people get toyed with and killed and we'll never know anything about it. So it's not awful, but I'm passionless about this film, so it's not recommend.
Stuart.
I think what this film has done, and maybe the struggle you're having, Jacob, is that it took the first scene of a movie and extended it to feature length. We've seen this moment many, many times, but it's only the kickoff to Scream or When a Stranger Calls, right? Like, we're going to just give 15 minutes to have this great opening where you think the Drew Barrymore is going to get it because she's in a safe place, playing a little game with a stranger, and then finds out she's in some real trouble, gets axed, and then we go and have the movie. But I would hold up. Think about it. Is that not the highlight of Scream, the entire franchise?
It is. It should have ended after that Drew Barrymore kill. I do agree with that.
That's what I'm saying. This movie made that decision that will never be any better than if we go on beyond. So we're just not going to do the rest of Scream. We're not going to do the next 70 minutes of When a Stranger Calls with Carol Kane. We're just going to do the cool 15 minutes, and we're going to keep that going for as long as we can. And why I'm recommending this movie highly is they sustain that for the feature length. They don't stretch it. They sustain it. This movie is scary as shit from start to finish. And I do think the ambiguity ultimately is more help than hindrance. You could argue that perhaps they needed a little something something at the end, a little twist to give it an extra sense of purpose. But the case Arnie has made is one that I think works for this film, that what can scare us oftentimes is that we don't get answers, that we live in a world where everything is Googleable, and when we don't have an answer, it's the craziest, most frustrating, most frightening thing of all. That bad could happen and no one's responsible is an existential nightmare. So, yeah, I don't know that this movie means anything. I don't think it has the layers of Straw Dogs. It's not going to be my favorite home invasion. But when I think about like movies that do a great job of scaring the shit out of me, this one ranks very, very high. They have managed to sustain that feeling of when you're in a familiar or unfamiliar place late at night and hearing things creak and hearing sounds from where you don't think they should be. This movie captures that better than any I could think of. And it does it better than Purge, You're Next, Don't Breathe. I think this is going to be my favorite one of the entire franchise. This is almost as good as Wes Anderson's brilliant Midnight Coterie of the Sinister Intruders.
All I could think of with this one is that SNL sketch.
Totally his underrated film. Maybe one day we'll cover it when they actually make it. But yeah, I'm really excited about this series, and this is a great way to kick it off. I recommend.
And I agree with you, Stuart. I wasn't sure, based on Straw Dogs, how I would feel about getting into an entire season donation drive and main feed of home invasion films. And then I got to spend some time with The Strangers and realize, damn, this movie really was good when I saw that back 13 years ago. And what gets me is that it does just sustain the tension. This is a plate-spinning act. And it is surprising that this is a first-time screenwriter, third script ever, but first time ever getting a script picked up, first-time director. He must have had help, because we haven't really heard a whole lot from him since.
I've seen his next movie, actually, but we could talk about that next week.
But I just think that the fact that this is... it's a one-note trick. I think that because of the performances being given, and while I didn't think they needed actors behind those masks, God knows, the body language and the movements of the three strangers add a lot. Liv owns the screen, which is something I never thought I'd say about Liv.
No, yeah, totally agree with that.
Understand, go back to our Incredible Hulk review. Go back to our Lord of the Rings stuff. Liv is not my favorite person in this planet, and here, she's... incredible.
Almost as good as when Ben Affleck had animal crackers go across her tummy.
But they keep the tension almost completely. Again, I said that I, at the very end, when they start getting to the radio and things, I'm like, maybe we needed to mix it up just a little bit more, have somebody else come out. Maybe remember Mike had a phone before you're bleeding out on the floor. There's options there, but then they get captured 5 minutes after I'm wondering when they're going to get on with it. And to me, it's chilling. Why are you doing this? Because you were home. That is the scariest fucking thing in the world right there. It's the randomness. It's, you know, as brutal as a car accident.
Well, they wouldn't have done it if they weren't home, because there wouldn't have been any victims. I just think that's such a silly reason.
I get the semantics you want to play, Jacob, but to me...
I'm not playing semantics. It's a silly statement. I never...
Why are you doing this to us? The reason we're doing it to you is because you were home. And why are we doing this at all? That wasn't the question you asked. You said, why are you doing this to us?
Now who's playing semantics?
Arnie, I don't think you're going to convince him.
If I asked, I would go, no shit, killer. I know I'm home. But why are you killing people and torturing them? That's what I meant.
I hear, Jacob, you wanted a twist. You wanted a twist ending that would explain.
Not even a twist, an exploration of humanity. You get at something. It doesn't need to be a M. Night twist for me. I want it to get at something deeper, though.
Well, I fully enjoyed this and appreciated that level of ambiguity behind motive, and give this a really, really solid recommend. And, you know, I've never seen the sequel. I'm excited, though. Wondering why it took so long to get to, but...
yeah, that is the curious thing, is you would think that they would be quick next year, 6 months. Like, how fast can we churn out part 2, 3, and 5? It will take a decade and an entirely new creative force in front of and behind the camera. We'll talk about it all next week.
So thank you for your support. Jacob Stuart, thank you for joining me. And until next time...
leave us alone!
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
If you want, we can talk some more.
It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating.
It's really nice, everything you did.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Are you a sinner?
Sometimes.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
I made mistakes. A lot of them.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Come on, we should get it.
Wait.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
She doesn't have to like it. Not why we're doing this.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2021, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
It'll be easier next time.
Pretty much as soon as it was available through Netflix when they used to mail you discs.
They still do, I think.
I get them.
You're one of the few.
It takes forever.
Even I quit that process.
There are some things that don't stream.
So, here, she's incredible.
Almost as good as when Ben Affleck had animal crackers go across her tummy.
I haven't seen that movie, and now I still don't want to see that movie.
You know what movie it is, though.
It has to be Armageddon.
Yes.
Although they did also have a romance in Jersey Girl, but...
Oh, wow. I forgot that
I haven't
existed.
Seen that one.
She's this...
That animal cracker scene is crazy.
I thought that was J-Lo, but she's only a small part of that. Now I'm remembering.
Yes. J-Lo dies, and then Liv Tyler comes in.
That animal cracker scene is crazy. Just Google the animal cracker scene, Stuart.
I might.
Do you think there's anyone on this whole planet doing the same thing we are right now?
No, no one's ever done that.